The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Morris Williams, and it's my privilege to welcome you to another wonderful evening of an author event at the Free Library of Philadelphia. May I ask you to please turn off your cell phones and any other musical instruments that you might have brought that might distract from people's ability to enjoy the talk by our author. You have an excellent write-up in your program about Dr. Aslam. Perhaps you might be interested to know that he lives in Los Angeles, although he grew up in the Bay Area. He came with his parents to the United States when he was 7 years old, so he has been shaped by the American experience. He has two-year-old sons, which adds a note of excitement to his life. He's on book tour, but his life will become more complicated because on September 30th, he resumes his teaching responsibilities, and you might be interested to know that the two courses he's teaching starting September the 30th, one is on the Sufis, a seminar, and the second is a class or graduate course on creative writing, which, if you see in the bio, really reflects the dual concentration that he's had with religion and with creative writing. In addition to his books, he also writes for such journals as Foreign Policy and Foreign Affairs, and in fact, his most recent article in the new issue of Foreign Affairs is about the persecution of Christians in the Middle East. So he has a broad range of interests that I think will appeal to all of us. I urge you to buy a copy of the book. If you haven't read it, you will find it, I think, to be a very exciting and challenging work. And I'd just like to read two quick quotations from the early part of the book. Quote, "My hope with this book is to spread the good news of Jesus in history. Also, the Jesus that is uncovered in the process may not be the Jesus we expect. He certainly will not be the Jesus that most modern Christians would recognize. But in the end, he is the only Jesus that we can access by historical means. Everything else is a matter of faith." Ladies and gentlemen, join in a warm welcome to Philadelphia to Reza Aslam.
Hi. Wow. Hello. Thank you, everyone. What a great crowd. Thank you, Morris, for that warm introduction and for your hospitality and obviously for all that you do for this wonderful library. Thank you, everyone, and welcome tonight. So I do not read. I'm not a reader. I don't know about you, but I cannot pay attention to an author who reads his own works. It doesn't matter who the author is. It doesn't matter how interesting it is. You know, it could be Jesus reading from his personal diary, and I've got about 5 minutes of attention that I can give it. So I don't like to read, and I'm not going to. What I like is conversations. We have an hour together, and rather than spending 45 minutes prattling on about what I think you want to hear about, I'd like to get straight to what you'd like to talk about. So if you will just permit me about 10 minutes to tell you a little bit about who I am, what this book is and is not about. There's a lot of misinformation about what the book is about, and why I wrote it, and then we'll get right to the Q&A, if you don't mind. So, as Morris said, I was born in Iran. My family fled Iran in 1979 during the Iranian Revolution. My father, who is a devout atheist, never really trusted the Ayatollah Khomeini or the mullahs, and he just assumed that, you know, that once the revolution happened, that despite all the promises to the contrary, that Khomeini would ultimately take over the country. And so he thought it would be a good idea if we just left for a little while. That was 30-something years ago. And every single day since then, he has reminded me about how right he was. Did not grow up with a lot of religion in Iran. We were culturally Muslim, the way so many people are around the world, culturally religious. It was part of our identity. It was part of who we were. But we weren't a particularly devout family. When we came to the United States, we, you know, in an attempt to kind of assimilate into American culture, did everything that we could to sort of put aside our ethnic and cultural and religious past, especially for me as a 8-9-year-old growing up in the U.S. in the 1980s. I don't know if you remember the 1980s. It wasn't exactly the best time to be either Iranian or Muslim in the United States. I guess not much has changed now that I think about it, actually. So... But as I've said before, I spent a good part of the early 80s pretending to be Mexican, which as I often note that you know that your particular ethnic community is in trouble when you assume that Americans will treat you better if you say you're Mexican. Yeah. Did not, so really, you know, what sort of small religious life that I had in Iran more or less went away in the United States. But I was always deeply interested in religion and spirituality. I mean, I truly believed that my childhood images of revolutionary Iran and the power that religion has to transform a society for good and for bad never left me. It really burned itself into my consciousness in a deep and meaningful way. And so despite not having any kind of religious edification at home, growing up in any kind of religious family, I was, even from a young age, not just interested in religion, but also deeply interested in spirituality. When I was a teenager, I went to a Christian youth group camp with some friends, and this was the first time that I heard the gospel story, this remarkable story about God, the God of heavens and the earth, coming down in the form of a child, growing up, taking the sins of the world upon him, dying for our sins, and the idea that belief in him can lead to eternal life. This was truly the greatest story I'd ever heard, and immediately converted to a very conservative brand of evangelical Christianity. Spent the next 4 or 5 years or so really preaching this gospel message as I had understood it to everyone that I could meet, whether they wanted to hear it or not. Including my mother. I actually converted my mother to evangelical Christianity. She's still a Christian today. And then when I went to college, I decided that I was going to do this for a living, that I was going to study the Bible, study religion for a living. Went to a Jesuit Catholic university, Santa Clara University, and under the tutelage of the Jesuits began for the first time studying the scriptures, studying the Jesus from a historical perspective. And I, you know, had the experience that frankly a lot of scholars of religion have, which is you immediately are confronted with information that you did not know before. A chasm began to open between what I was learning about the Jesus of history and what I had been taught about the Christ of faith, at least from my particular very conservative church background. And I guess the only way that I can put it is that I became far more interested in the historical Jesus. I wanted to know him more. I wanted to put it in Christian terms, I wanted to have a personal relationship with this guy much more so than I think I ever had any kind of connection with the sort of celestial spirit that I had been taught about in church. The Jesus of history became more real and accessible to me. And although I ultimately moved away from the Christian church. I did not give up my studies and continued to research and work on the historical Jesus and the origins of Christianity. And it was actually at that moment that the seeds of this book were planted in the academic work that I was doing at Santa Clara and that I continue to do in my other degrees. What is this book about? Well, let me tell you what it's not about, first of all. It's not about Christianity. And the reason I say that is because, although this may come as a surprise to some of you, Jesus was not a Christian. Jesus was a Jew. So the idea that this is a book about Christianity is just not correct. It's a book about Judaism, and specifically Second Temple Judaism. And I'm going to come back to this notion of Jesus the Jew in a moment here. And certainly I'm sure some of our questions will open up this discussion, because it is the single most important thing to understand when talking about the historical Jesus as opposed to the Christ of faith. What the book is about is an attempt to break through the layers, 2,000 years of interpretation of doctrine and dogma, legend and myth that have accumulated around the person of Jesus, and try as much as possible to get to the core of the individual himself. I'm certainly not the only person who has tried to do this. The quest for the historical Jesus, as many of you may know, is something that's been going on for 2 centuries now, 200 years of trying to get to the historical Jesus. And in many ways, what this book represents is a distillation, of that 2 centuries of research. It's an attempt to kind of make it accessible and appealing to a wider, general, broader audience. But I do think it's important to understand that this quest for the historical Jesus has hit a lot of bumps in the road. There's a lot of debate, a lot of argumentation among scholars. It's what we do. Over who Jesus truly was, what he meant, what he said, what parts of his gospel story we can take as historically accurate and what we can't. If you've seen the book, you've noticed that the entire last third of the book, some 80 to 90 pages or so, is dedicated to outlining that argument, to talk about the different scholarly debates over the things that you've read in the book. The book itself tries to push the research and all of that stuff out as much as possible so that it's an enjoyable reading experience. But for those of you who are interested in the academic work behind the conclusions of the book, I definitely encourage you to look at the notes section. There are many scholars, I have to be honest with you, who have abandoned this quest altogether. In fact, in the 1950s and 60s, when the quest for the historical Jesus reached its zenith with the so-called Jesus seminars, where a group of scholars decided to come together in a room and do a color-coded version of the Bible. And you can actually still go and buy that version of the Gospels. It's color-coded in different colors as to what is probably most historically accurate to what is least historically accurate. And the fact that you're laughing should give you an idea as to how that was treated by both the general audience and by the scholarly community. It was kind of the jump the shark moment for the historical Jesus studies. Nowadays, to be honest with you, many scholars have kind of abandoned the idea altogether. And they've abandoned it for one very important reason, which is that outside of the New Testament, there is almost no trace of this man. We have a fairly reliable, in my opinion, throwaway line that one finds in the writings of a first century Jewish historian by the name of Flavius Josephus, who wrote in the year 94 CE, so 60 years after Jesus' death. That's it. That's the only proof that we have that this man existed beyond what is written about him in the Gospels. And so I think many scholars have decided that it's not enough. And so therefore we should stop even thinking about, worrying about the historical Jesus. Instead, we should think about the only Jesus that we can access. And that is, of course, the Christ of faith. I disagree. I think that if you commit yourself to taking what there is fairly unanimous consensus when it comes to Jesus. And I believe that there are about three things that if you get 100 Jesus scholars in a room, they'll more or less agree on three things. Number one, that Jesus was a Jew. Again, it's a good reminder. I will be reminding you of that probably four more times before the evening is over. That number two, he started a Jewish movement sometime in the first third of the first century, a movement whose ultimate goal was the creation of the kingdom of God. And that number three, as a result of that movement, Rome crucified him as a state criminal. More or less, that's probably the three things that scholars of the New Testament will agree upon. My argument is that it's enough. Because while we know very, very little about Jesus, the historical Jesus, we know so much about the world in which he lived. First century Palestine, as it's often referred to, because of the Roman occupation, was a period that was very well documented. The Romans, if they were good at anything, were good at documentation and killing people. Documentation and killing people. Those were their two real strengths. And roads. But that's it. So what I try to do, what scholars have tried to do for some time now, is to take that little bit of information about Jesus to place him firmly in the context of his time, and then to allow that context to give shape to who Jesus is. And then we can go to the New Testament, we can go to the Gospels and analyze the claims of the Gospels according to what we know about the history of the time in order to decide whether those claims are historically accurate or not, and what is not most likely factually accurate. That's what this book does. It's all that this book does. Now, I will say that when you do that, the picture of Jesus that arises from that historical experiment looks different than the picture of Jesus that I think many Christians have. This kind of notion of a pacifistic preacher of good works with no concern over the cares of this world, that image begins to melt away when you recognize the tumultuous era in which Jesus lived. Perhaps the most tumultuous era of the Holy Land, which is saying a lot, actually. And so as a result of that, the Jesus that arises is a Jesus that is far more revolutionary, far more nationalistic, far more concerned with the fate of the Jews and their freedom from the bondage of this oppressive, brutal, bloody Roman occupation that controlled every aspect of life in the first century for the Jews, and one in which ultimately led to the same place that every other claimant to the Messiah in Jesus' time, and I write about 12 of them, led, which is to execution by Rome for the crime of sedition or treason, which is, by the way, the only crime for which you could be crucified under Roman law, crucifixion. We'll talk about that in a little bit later. That's the thesis of the book. And then finally, why did I write this book? Well, obviously, there is my secret Muslim agenda to destroy Christianity. There's that. That's one reason. But I did have another. I had another agenda. I had a second agenda in writing this book. And in a sense, it's actually two kind of audiences. What I wanted to do for believers is to give them a glimpse as to the consequences of the fundamental belief of Christianity, which is that Jesus is fully God and fully man. He is both those things simultaneously. The problem with that belief is that so often the man part gets subsumed by the God part for many Christians. I know it did when I was a Christian. Rarely did we actually hear about the man part. We mostly heard about the God part. And when we did hear about the man part, it was always very difficult to kind of forget about the other thing. When you tried to think about Jesus as a human being living in a specific time and place, suffering, being lonely, being tired, being hungry, being scared, living as a person, experiencing human emotions, there was always this, safety net underneath him because, he's God. And it made it very, very hard for me, and I know for a lot of Christians, to truly understand what it means to say that Jesus was also a man. I sometimes refer to it as, watching a tightrope walker with a net. It's just not that interesting. I mean, if he falls, he's fine. That's, I think, the problem with trying to maintain the sort of the mystery of the incarnation in the human mind. And so what I wanted to do for a believing audience is to say that if you truly believe that Jesus was also a man, then you need to understand the world in which he lived, because that world shaped who he was. His teachings were directed at a specific audience. They addressed specific social ills. They were in confrontation with specific religious and political authorities. And if you truly, truly want to know who this man was, you have to know the world in which he lived. For a non-believing audience, what I wanted to do was to explain why this man is important, why you can believe that he wasn't God or he wasn't, the Messiah or the Son of God or whatever, and still recognize how extraordinary this individual was. In fact, I often say that the reason I wanted to write this book is to show people that you can be a follower of Jesus without necessarily being a Christian, that the example that he set and the way that he confronted the oppression of the marginalized and the dispossessed, his message of social justice, of economic justice, his vision for a new world order in which the social status would be reversed. These were things that are as resonant 2,000 years ago as they are today. So you don't have to necessarily believe that Jesus is God to understand that he is someone worth knowing and worth following. So that is a little bit about me and the book and why I wrote it, and I think that's enough. And what I'd like to do at this point, there I think are people on both sides of the aisles with microphones, and you just raise your hand and I'm happy to sort of pick you. I like to go boy, girl, if that's okay with you, or gentlemen, ladies, however you'd like to be known. Now this is this part, let me just, one moment, it's sort of mandatory that I say that although I am deeply, deeply interested in your views and your opinions, this is really not the place for them. That's outside when you accost me, and I'm happy to hear him. I'm happy to hear him outside. But just so that we get as many questions as possible, and because I'm a professor, it takes me forever to answer these questions, but I'll try to make them short. If you can, please just give me a question, and I will try to answer it as quickly as I can. So let's just start right there in the middle with this gentleman in the blue. And I promise I will not ignore the back.
Could you talk to us about the miracles?
The miracles of Jesus. Yeah, how does a historian deal with that? This is a problem, actually. This is a real problem for a lot of historians, and particularly of scholars of religion. I'm going to let you in on a little secret about religion scholars. Most of us are diehard atheists. Most of us don't believe in any of this stuff. My colleagues, I can tell you for a fact, look at faith the way that like a biologist looks at a microbe, I do not. I am a person of faith. I'm a Muslim. And I do believe in God. And so, obviously, since I believe in God, I am open to some pretty absurd premises. And so I have to be very careful when I write about things like the resurrection or Jesus's miracles, because from the modern point of view, it's absurd. Come on. You know, this is ridiculous. It's hard to believe. Here's the problem, is that we actually have more historical evidence confirming Jesus' status as a miracle worker than we have of anything else about his life. We have more evidence about that than we have about his birth, about his death, about anything else. In fact, by the way, let me just clarify what I mean here. I don't mean to say that we have historical evidence to prove any particular miraculous action by Jesus. I'm not saying that we have proof that he walked on water or proof that he healed the sick or the lame or whatever. What I'm saying is that the one thing that it seems that his worshipers and his detractors, his friends and his enemies, the Christians who came in the first and second century who began to write about him, and the Jewish and pagan detractors who wrote against him, the one thing that they all agreed on and took for granted was that Jesus was a miracle worker. No one questioned that. No one questioned that he was a healer, that he was an exorcist. But again, let's put this in context. There were many healers and exorcists in Jesus' time. In fact, the wandering exorcist was an actual profession. Like, that was a legitimate profession, and a pretty well-paid one, too, by the way. And so was healings. I mean, this is not a time in which you have a bunch of doctors, you know, sitting around in hospitals. And also, it's important to understand that the line between illness and exorcism was very fuzzy. If you look at the Gospel of Mark, almost a third of that entire gospel, the first gospel written in around 70-71 AD, the very first gospel, almost a third of it is just Jesus' healings. And most of those healings are exorcisms. It seems very clear that Jesus was viewed by the majority of the Jews as his time, not as the Messiah or the Son of God or anything else, but as just another one of these traveling healers and exorcists. And as I say, there were dozens of them. This was a time that was steeped in magic and myth and miracle and the way that we would understand them. But there was something that set Jesus apart. And I think this is what's interesting. What set Jesus apart from his fellow healers and exorcists is that Jesus did it for free. This sounds like a weird statement, but we actually have evidence in the Gospels that Jesus deliberately did not charge for his healings and his exorcisms. In fact, when he endows his apostles with the gift of healing, he says to them, "Give this out for free. You have received it for free. Give it out for free," in the Gospel of Luke. That makes him unusual. Because as I say, while he was one of hundreds of these guys, everybody else charged for it. It was a profession. This is what you did for a living. And Jesus did not. Which also explains, by the way, why so often, you know, when he would enter these towns and villages, he would be inundated by the poor, the sick, the lame. I mean, everyone knew immediately that a free healer had entered their cities. Now, how you actually define those healings, how you define those miracles and those exorcisms, that's a matter of faith. I have no interest in defining those things. That's not my job. That's your job. If you're a believer, you think that this was God's interaction on earth. If you're a non-believer, then you think, oh, well, you know, the possessed person was actually an epileptic, and the healings weren't actually healings; they were psychological. Whatever, that's up to you. It's not up to me. But the one thing that I can tell you from a historian's perspective is that no one doubted Jesus in his status as a miracle worker. Okay, it's time for a lady. Yes, right there, and then I'll go back.
You don't mention the Old Testament. I was curious. In your studies, have you studied the Old Testament and the prophecies, the many prophecies, which led up to the gospel? and the birth of the Messiah. Mm-hmm. And what about the Dead Sea Scrolls, which were found in 1946?
Very good. Let me start with the Dead Sea Scrolls, if you don't mind. The Dead Sea Scrolls have been a treasure trove of information to scholars about what Jewish spirituality was like in the time of Jesus. The Dead Sea Scrolls were, many of them, by the way, are just collections of Hebrew texts, Hebrew scriptures, what is often referred to as the Old Testament. Though I don't use that term. Scholars use the term Hebrew scriptures because, frankly, the Old Testament is kind of a derogatory term. Jews would say there's, nothing old about it except that it's age. There are a number of new writings in the Dead Sea Scrolls, many of which were written most likely by a group of Jewish sectarians by the name of the Essenes, who existed in multiple places throughout Judea and the Galilee, but who made their homes on a dry plateau in this sort of monastic environment called Qumran. They rejected the temple. They rejected the priestly authorities. They saw themselves as the only true Jews. They tried desperately to maintain their purity, their ritual purity. They tried to really distance themselves from the rest of the Jews and certainly from the heathen Roman Empire by divorcing themselves from society. And they wrote a great number of texts about how they understood Second Temple Jewish spirituality that have been enormously helpful for us to understand what Judaism was like in Jesus's time. These texts, unfortunately, tell us nothing about Jesus at all or about Christianity, because Christianity didn't exist when these texts were being written, certainly not in the way that we understand it. And nobody wrote about Jesus because nobody cared. I mean, in Jesus's life, he was just this sort of marginal, poor, pious peasant from the backwoods of Galilee. It was only much, much later that people obviously took notice of this man because of the claims that were made of him. That's the Dead Sea Scrolls. Very, very good question. The question about the prophecies in the Hebrew Bible is a little bit more complex. Yes, of course, I have to emphasize that I said four more times, here's one of those times, Jesus was a Jew. So the only scriptures that Jesus was even remotely familiar with was the scriptures of the Hebrew Bible, the Torah, the Law, the Prophets. That's all that Jesus knew. It was how he understood his world and his spirituality, and that was the only way that he understood his role and his spirituality. The question becomes, if you read the New Testament, there is an enormous amount of effort by particularly the gospel writers to try to take the myriad and often conflicting prophecies about the Messiah that are scattered throughout the Hebrew scriptures and to fit Jesus according to those prophecies. There are two problems with that. Number one, the prophecies are all over the place. Some say that when the Messiah comes, he will be born in Bethlehem, the city of David. Some say when the Messiah comes, no one will know where he is born. Some say that the Messiah will be the seed of David. Some do not. Some talk about the Messiah in a very priestly function. Some talk about him in a very kingly function. And the reason for this is because the scriptures were written over thousands of years. It's not like one guy sat down and began Genesis, and then wrote all the way to the end. That's, these are hundreds of different hands writing over thousands of years. So, of course, the prophecies are all over the place. Of course they are. For the early Christian community, it was very important, of course, if you're going to call Jesus the Messiah, you have to fit him according to at least some of these prophecies. And so they did what everyone did who claimed to be the Messiah. They picked and chose. They just simply picked those prophecies that they thought were sort of most significant. And then they transformed Jesus' story to fit those prophecies. Do you understand what I'm saying? So from a perspective of faith, those prophecies actually foretold Jesus's words and actions. The things that Jesus did were in fulfillment of the ancient prophecies. That is a perfectly valid, perfectly fine view. There's nothing wrong with that. From the historian's point of view, we look at the way in which Jesus' life was manipulated, so for instance, his birth in Bethlehem, as a means of doing whatever it took to get Jesus to fit what those prophecies are. Let me here for a moment talk about one of these examples. The birth in Bethlehem is a very good one. Bethlehem is a word that shows up three times in the entire New Testament. Matthew and Luke refer to it once each. Matthew says Jesus was born in Bethlehem. He doesn't explain it in any way. And Luke talks about this whole census that gets Jesus to Bethlehem. The only other time that Bethlehem is mentioned is in the Gospel of John, when someone says that Jesus is the Messiah, and someone says, he's not the Messiah. The Messiah has to be born in Bethlehem. And he's obviously a Nazarene. We know where he is from. He came here from Nazareth with his family. And Jesus, by the way, does not deny it. Jesus doesn't say, oh, no, but you see, there was this census, and I was born in actually Bethlehem. Because he wasn't. Jesus was known throughout his life by one word, the Nazarene. In fact, that was his name. People did not call Jesus Yeshua. You have to understand that in Jesus' world, every third person was named Yeshua. I mean, if you were in a room and you said Jesus, 30 people would say, huh? But Nazareth was a village that was so small, so inconsequential, a village that didn't even have a road. It didn't have a bath. It didn't have a school. It didn't have a synagogue. This was a village of mud and brick homes that probably housed anywhere between 100 and 200 families. In fact, the village of Nazareth is so inconsequential that the name Nazareth does not appear on any map prior to the end of the first century. Many scholars believe that there was no such place as Nazareth for that very reason, though I think that they're incorrect. What everyone seemed to agree upon was that Jesus was a Nazarene, which is where his birth was, which is where the city that he was from. Now, the early Christian community did not have a problem with this because they didn't care where Jesus was from. The earliest writings about Jesus, the Gospel of Mark, which was written, as I say, sometime after 70 AD, anywhere between 70 and 73, 74 AD, and the letters of Paul, which I guess the first letter of Paul, most scholars date 1 Thessalonians to be about 48 AD, and the last letter of Paul, which most scholars believe was Romans, was written probably 60 AD. Understand that all of these dates are, you know, not exact, that they're estimates. The letters of Paul never mention Bethlehem or Jesus' birth. It's not until the era of Matthew and Luke, we're talking about 90 to 100 AD, so 60 to 70 years after Jesus' death, that this problem arises, the problem that you see in the Gospel of John, where Jews especially say to Jesus' followers, what are you talking about? This Nazarene can't be the Messiah, because the Messiah is not born in Nazareth. The Messiah is born in Bethlehem, which again is true only in a couple of prophecies. Other prophecies contradict that. And so some clever means has to arise in order to get Jesus to Bethlehem, to be born in Bethlehem. Again, Matthew doesn't care. He doesn't bother to give an example. He just says, and then Jesus was born in Bethlehem. And then he moves on about his life in Nazareth. But Luke comes up with an answer. He says that in the year 6 AD, Rome called for a census to be called across the entire Roman world. And according to Luke, what the census required was that every single subject of the Roman Empire had to go to the birthplace of their father in order to be counted. And the birthplace of Jesus' father, Joseph, was Bethlehem. And so Mary and Joseph, pregnant Mary and Joseph, you all remember this story, travel from Nazareth to Bethlehem, and while in Bethlehem, in a manger next to some sheep and a cow, Jesus is born. And so therefore, he's born in Bethlehem, problem solved. Here's the problem. While it is true that in the year 6 AD, Rome did call for a census, it wasn't of the entire world. It was of Judea, Idumea, and Perea, not Galilee, which is where Jesus lived. So the census would not have affected Jesus in any way, anyway. Also, it should bear mentioning that 6 AD is not what most scholars believe is Jesus' birth. Most scholars accept the year given by Matthew. Matthew gives a completely different date for Jesus' birth. Matthew says that Jesus was born in 4 BC, the year in which Herod dies. So there's a 10-year discrepancy right there between Matthew and Luke. But more importantly, as I had said in my earlier comments, we know a lot about Roman law. They were very good at writing things down, especially when it came to taxes, which is what the purpose of a census was. The reason you call for a census is for taxation purposes. There is nothing written in any Roman document of the time ever to say that Roman law required you to be counted not in the place of residence, but in the place of your father's birth. In fact, the idea boggles the mind. Let me explain to you what Luke is saying here. What he is saying is that every once in a while, every subject of the greatest empire the world had ever known would have to stop what they were doing, uproot themselves and their families, travel great distances to the land of their father's birth, and then wait there for weeks, months, for a Roman official to come and count them and their property, which they would have left in their place of residence. The story is factually inaccurate. Here is the most important point. Luke knew it was factually inaccurate. He knew that what he was writing was historically incorrect. He's writing in the year 90. He's a Roman subject. He is still living under Roman law. Luke's audience knew that what Luke wrote was factually incorrect. They too are subjects of Rome. They live under Roman law. They know that this is not how it happens. They didn't care. If there is anything that you get out of this evening, I hope it's this thing right here. What you and I call history, the accumulation of empirically verifiable facts and dates, is wholly a product of the modern world. That definition of history is barely 300 years old. What the ancient mind called history had very little to do with facts. It had to do with truth. And truth and fact in the ancient mind, particularly when it comes to sacred history, are two completely different things. Luke didn't care about the facts of the story that I just told you, because the facts to him were irrelevant. If you said to him, "But wait, that's not how it happened," he wouldn't know what you're talking about. He would say, "I'm sorry, did you not hear what I just said? What I said was Jesus is the Messiah because he was born in Bethlehem and he is the descendant of King David, here to reestablish the kingdom of David on earth." The way that I have the metaphor that I often use to explain this, which might make sense of this, because I know that this is a very difficult thing to kind of understand because we are products of the modern world. To us, history means something completely different. If I were writing about Morris, okay, it's 2,000 years ago, and I'm writing, the Gospel of Morris, and what I want to do is explain that Morris is a selfless individual, a deeply giving individual, very giving of himself and very compassionate. What I wouldn't write is that Morris is very selfless and compassionate. That's not how it goes. This is what I would write. One day, Morris went outside of his home, and it was a very cold day, and he saw a homeless man on the street, naked and shivering. And Morris took off his shirt and gave it to the homeless man and walked off naked himself. Now, did that actually happen? Maybe. Maybe not. But you missed the point. The point of the story has nothing to do with the facts of the story. The point of the story has to do with the truth of the story. And the truth of the story is that Morris is the kind of guy who would give you the shirt off his back. That's how the Gospels were written. That's how they were intended to be read. That's how they were read for most of the last 2,000 years. And it is only very recently, as a product of the scientific revolution, which told us that, no, that which is true is that which can be factually verified, that we have all of a sudden begun to read the Gospels in a way that they were never, ever intended to be read, and that is literally. That was a long answer. I promise they will not all be that long. Can we go in the back, please, all the way in the back corner, the gentleman in the black?
I want to bring you back to the color-coded New Testament. And in particular, you made two references to Luke. Most recently, that he was factually incorrect. But you said earlier that you know that Jesus did not charge for his miracles because in Luke, it says so.
Very good.
So.
I love this question. How do we know?
So the question is, how do you know when the New Testament, the Gospels are correct, and how do you know when they are not?
Very good question, and a very important one. Well, look, there is actually, the methodology for this has been in place, as I say, for two centuries, the sort of exegetical analysis of the scriptures is something that's been going on for a very, very long time. And there are these tools of the trade, and they involve a whole host of complex things. So, for instance, we have one tool that we call multiple attestations. So if a story shows up in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, it's more likely to be historically accurate than if it only shows up, say, in John, or if it only shows up in Luke. That's one way. Another way that we do is this what I sometimes refer to as the sore thumb method. It's the opposite of what I just said. If a story shows up that seems to just kind of come out of nowhere, or a statement or a quotation by Jesus that seems to really contradict the sort of overall impression or the overall themes of Jesus' teachings in the gospel, then it's probably correct, because it's hard to imagine why it would be there. A very famous example of this is the one that starts my book, where Jesus says, "Do not think that I have come to bring peace on earth. I have not come to bring peace, but the sword." That verse sticks out like a sore thumb. You think, what in the world is that doing there? Well, scholars would say it's there because it actually happened. That's why. There are a whole host of other things to do, but to put it in its simplest way possible, what we do is we take the claims of the Gospels and we analyze them according to what we know about the history of the time. We know, for instance, that Luke's nativity story is factually incorrect, because we know how Roman taxation and census worked. And if it conflicts, that means it's wrong. We know that what was the other thing? What was the other part of Luke's thing that I was saying, which I completely forgot? Oh, yes. We know that that's probably historically accurate, because we know that the common way in which miracle workers worked in that time was to charge. So it sticks out as a sore thumb when he says, "Give it out for free." Immediately you think, wait, that's different. So it's a little more complex than what I'm just saying, but there are these tools that have been in place for a very long time. I don't mean to say that we all agree. We don't all agree. You can take two scholars who have been trained in the exact same discipline, who are using the exact same methodology, and they will disagree about whether a verse is historical or not. That's what the debate has been all about. But that's the methodology that we use. It's not about just picking and choosing what you like. It's about figuring out what you can zero in on, what is most historically likely and what is least historically likely. Very good question. It's a lady's turn, and I think there's one right there in the pink.
Thank you. I'm curious if you could expound a little bit about where you end the book, which is to talk about James and the period of time immediately after Jesus, because there's this wonderful break there where he has died and then we don't really get these first gospels for such a period of time. So could you talk about that?
Thank you. Yes, the last section of the book is about what happens after the crucifixion and the multiple ways in which Jesus's teachings are understood. There are essentially two major branches. I mean, it's, again, much more complex than this. There were many, many ways in which Jesus' message was understood, but they can be more or less defined into two major branches, each with its own sort of leader. The first branch was precisely what you're referring to, which was led by Jesus' brother James. Some of you may not know, Jesus had four brothers, James, Joseph, Judas, and Simon, and then an untold number of sisters who unfortunately are not named in the Gospels, but they are mentioned that he has sisters. One of those brothers, James, ended up becoming really the successor to Jesus, the most significant leader of the movement after Jesus' death. He was known as the Bishop of Bishops. He was in charge of what was called the Mother Assembly, which sort of is the Jerusalem church. They didn't use the word church back then, not yet. But the Mother Assembly in Jerusalem was in charge of all the other assemblies that arose everywhere else, in Ephesus and Antioch and Alexandria, etc., etc. And James was in charge of all of these. He was in charge of the apostles. He was the head. He wasn't himself an apostle, but he was in charge of the apostles. In fact, Peter referred to him as the Bishop of Bishops. Here's the thing about James, is that his view of what this movement was about was quite limiting. According to James, Jesus was a Jew. It's twice. Jesus was a Jew, and he preached Judaism. He had no interest in starting a new religion. This was a Jewish movement, and it was for Jews. James was okay if a non-Jew wanted to join the movement. He was fine with that, as long as you first became a Jew. Now, after a few years, according to the book of Acts, Peter ultimately convinces James to forego the requirement for circumcision, which is probably a good idea, marketing-wise. But nevertheless, although James ultimately decides to forego circumcision, he insists that if you want to join this movement, you have to follow the Torah, the Jewish law, including the dietary laws, the whole kit and caboodle, except for circumcision. That's James's impression of what this movement is supposed to be. And James is in charge. Remember that. Opposite of James is the view that is being expounded by Paul. Paul, many of you are familiar with, far more familiar with him than you are with James. Paul is the former Pharisee who lived in one of the wealthiest Roman port cities at the time called Tarsus. Very well-educated Jew, literate, Greek-speaking. Not wealthy, but not poor. James, like Jesus and all the apostles, was a poor, illiterate, uneducated peasant from Galilee, from Nazareth. So a country bumpkin. That's what we would refer to them nowadays. Paul is a Pharisee, educated, can read and write in multiple languages and including Greek, which is very important. Paul doesn't live in the Holy Land. He lives in the diaspora. He lives in a Roman city. Paul is a Roman citizen as opposed to James. Paul, as many of you know the story, Much later, after Jesus' death, it's important to understand Paul never knew Jesus, never met Jesus, never saw Jesus while he was alive at all, but has this ecstatic experience on the road to Damascus in which he is confronted by the risen Jesus. The experience is so profound that he abandons everything and joins this movement, becomes a follower of Jesus. But then he says something really interesting in Galatians. What he says is, rather than actually leave Damascus, go back to Jerusalem, and meet with the leaders of this movement, you know, the people who knew Jesus, who actually walked and talked with him, who ate with him, who were there when he was arrested, who were there when he was executed. Rather than do that, he decides that he's just going to go and start preaching this message right away. Because Paul says that he is receiving this message directly from the risen Jesus, not, as he somewhat dismissively puts it, from Jesus of the flesh, is the term that he uses. And this message in Paul's hands becomes something quite innovative. Paul says that Jesus wasn't a man. He was in the form of a man, but he wasn't man. He was God, that he was eternal, that all creation sprang from him, that his death on the cross became the final sacrifice for us all, that this original sin that he himself created, this notion that came from the fall of man and that is in every human being, is washed away by Jesus once and for all, and that all you need to do is believe in his name, is what he says. Believe in his name, and you too shall have eternal life. You too shall be in heaven next to Jesus, and you will judge all of humanity and the angels at the end of time. Now, if this sounds familiar, it should, because it's called Christianity. But you have to understand that for James, this was crazy. For James, this was, I mean, this goes against everything Judaism has ever said, thought, or believed about humanity, about God, about the relationship between creator and creation. The concept of a God-man is absolutely anathema to everything Judaism has ever thought or believed. It just doesn't exist. And the idea that to follow this movement, you can just divorce yourself from the law of Moses. Paul says, Christ is the end of the Torah. That drove James crazy, because James thinks the exact opposite. James thinks, no, this is the Torah. That's what we are following. We just happen to believe that the Messiah came and his name was Jesus, my brother. Now, in the lifetime of both men, you have to understand, James won the argument. I mean, let's face it, you don't argue against the flesh and blood brother of Jesus. What are you going to say? I mean, whatever you say, James would be like, yeah, I bunked with him. That's not what he meant. You know, James won that argument. And I go through a very long process about how you see this in the book of Acts and in Corinthians and Galatians, this deep, deep animosity between these two men who did not like each other at all. Paul refers to James and Peter and John, the three sort of main leaders of the church. He refers to them as the so-called pillars of the church. He openly says in Galatians, I learned nothing from these men. They mean nothing to me. James, on the other hand, on three separate occasions, summons Paul to Jerusalem to answer for his teachings. The last time that he summons him, in the year 57, he actually says, and this is, you see this in the book of Acts, he says to Paul, he says, it's come to our attention that you've been telling people that they don't need to follow the law of Moses. Now, we know that this cannot be true, but to prove that it's not true, and as he puts it, to set our brothers at ease, is the phrase that he uses, you're going to go to the temple and you're going to take part in a purification ritual. And and Paul does. In the book of Acts, Paul doesn't respond to this. He just goes and does it. Except that we all know that's exactly what Paul has been saying because we've read his letters. James didn't because he can't read. We've read his letters and we know that's exactly what Paul has been saying, that you do not have to follow the law of Moses anymore. In their lifetimes, James wins this argument. James is ascendant. James dies in the year 62. Paul dies in the year 66. Paul dies in Rome. James dies in Jerusalem. And then something else happens in the year 66. The Jews revolt. A band of zealots rise up against the Roman Empire. They miraculously kick Rome out of the Holy Land. They manage to keep them at bay for 4 years, mainly because Rome's got its own problems to deal with. They eventually fix those problems, and they go, oh yeah, the Jews. And then they return. And when they return, they slaughter everybody, man, woman, child. If you were loyal to Rome, if you were a rebel, they don't care. They burn the city of Jerusalem to the ground. They destroy the temple of God. They also burn to the ground the first church, the Jerusalem Assembly of James. And after that, Judaism itself, in punishment for the revolt, becomes pariah. It's no longer a legitimate cult in the Roman Empire. At that point, the Christians, the followers of Jesus, have a very easy decision to make. Do they continue to preach this message to Jews the way James wanted it? Or do they start preaching it to the victors, the Romans, instead? Now remember, until this point, not a single gospel has been written yet. Not one gospel has been written yet, up to what I've just said. And so that's when the transformation of this religion from, you know, this sort of nationalist movement for liberation becomes this Romanized, Hellenized idea. And the framework, the paradigm for preaching to the Romans has already been written by Paul. Paul's letters are still circulating around the Christian community. I mean, everybody in Jerusalem is dead. All of that has been destroyed. But not Ephesus, not Alexandria, not Antioch, not Galatia, not Corinth. And these were the communities where Paul had real influence outside in the diaspora. And so as a result, Paul all of a sudden gets rehabilitated. And Paul's conception of this movement, which of course is a deeply Romanized idea. I told you that for Jews, the idea of a God-man, it violates everything that Judaism has to say about God and man. For the Romans, God-man, sure. I mean, Caesar's a God-man. That makes perfect sense. And hence you see this slow, steady progression in which what we now understand to be Christianity arises. So can we do a gentleman? And we have time for one more. I'm sorry, time for one more question. And it's a gentleman. I'm sorry. Maybe in the back, way in the back. This better be a good one.
Thanks. I feel blessed to get the last question. I believe that you are of the belief that there is not necessarily an inconsistency between belief in a scripture, a story, a myth, and historical veracity. The two don't necessarily have to coexist. If I'm correct in your saying that and supporting people having religious beliefs, even though history doesn't support the story, does that lead to saying that a literal interpretation of scripture might not make sense, and consequently, religious fundamentalism might not make sense?
Well done. That is the perfect question to end our evening with. Thank you. First of all, you're absolutely right. I do believe that. I don't believe that there needs to be any kind of necessary conflict between faith and history. In fact, I truly believe that the dividing line when it comes to Jesus is not about whether you believe he's God or not, or whether you believe he's the Messiah or not, or that you believe he existed or not. The dividing line comes between what is probable, or what is possible, I should say, and what is likely. This is what I mean by this. Is it possible that Jesus, unlike 98% of his fellow Jews, was literate? Yes, it's possible. Is it likely? No. Is it possible that Jesus, unlike everything ever written or said about the Messiah, believed that his role as the Messiah was a divine office, that he thought he was God? Yes, it's possible. Is it likely? No, it's not likely. You either believe, and this is true, you can do this over and over again. Is it possible that Jesus died and rose from the dead 3 days later? Yeah, it's possible. Is it likely? No, it's not likely. The job of the historian is not to say what is possible. That's the job of faith. The job of the historian is to say what is likely. But these two things don't necessarily need to be in conflict with each other. On the contrary, it's perfectly reasonable to maintain a true abiding faith in the myths and metaphors of the scriptures, and also a healthy sense of the history of the time. I personally think that having a historical background actually informs and empowers your faith. Some people disagree with that, but I don't see why there needs to be a conflict between that. But ultimately, you either believe that Jesus was utterly unique, that he was unlike every other Jew of his time, that his conception of himself, that his understanding of God, his reading of the Hebrew scriptures was totally and completely innovative and unprecedented, or you believe that he was extraordinary, charismatic, remarkable, powerful, unique certainly, but not utterly so. That in a sense, he thought of himself and his office the way that every other Messiah thought of himself and his office. That he thought about God and about the relationship between creator and creation the way that every other Jew thought about those things. The historian falls into that camp, which is why we rely on his world to figure out who he was. Because if you know what other Jews thought and felt, then you have a better sense of what Jesus would have thought and felt. The person of faith falls into the other category. For the person of faith, Jesus is utterly unique. Jesus is unlike anyone who has ever come before or after. And so it doesn't help to put him in context. It's no use trying to figure out who he was by figuring out who everybody else was, because Jesus is without context. Both of those views are perfectly equally valid views, but one is a view born of faith and the other is a view born of history. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.